Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today, we have Dennis Jojovic doing part two of burns, and this is specifically on inhalation injuries, airway management, and a little bit about securing lines and tubes. Before we get to that, big news, just in time for April Fool's Day, but there is no lying here. This is true. This is an actual fact. We have a new member, a new blog and podcast joining the MCrit project, and that is The Toxin the Hound and the Dantastic Mr. Toxin Howard podcast. More about that at the end of the show. And just before we jump in with Dennis, one more recommendation. The Maryland CC Project has just put out a burn lecture that took place at Shock Trauma, and it is fantastic and is perfectly complementary to these first two parts because it deals much more with the ICU management long-term of these burn patients rather than the initial resuscitation. So listen to that as well. It performs a necessary filling in of the stuff we're not going to cover on these burn episodes on MCrit. Okay, let's get right into it. Why don't we go right into airway first? And, you know, something that's really changed in my practice and changed in the recommendations of my burn surgeons is who needs to be intubated in burns? And especially let's start with inhalation injury. When I was doing training, they told us, like, singed nasal hair, vocal changes, done, intubate. Is that still true?
Scott, I think that's always the million-dollar question. It's always easier to err on the side of caution and intubate everybody. But I think over time, we see that many of these patients do fine without being intubated. You know, certainly if you were in the position of working in a institution that is farther from definitive care and you are concerned about your patient and a transport is coming up, you don't know what's going to happen on that transport, I will never fault you for intubating that patient to be sure that they're going to be okay. Now, many of these patients, though, do okay. In fact, the ones that are in your institution and you have the burn surgeons and burn unit, we'll often just observe them and see what happens. The interesting thing about these inhalational injuries is that, you know, I think traditionally we're taught that these patients will deteriorate in front of our very eyes as soon as they roll in the door. And the first thing on our mind is airway, and we call anesthesia and surgery and everyone standing around the bed. But truthfully, it doesn't always work out that way. It usually seems to be the patients who need to be intubated are either intubated on scene or intubated hours down the road once the resuscitation continues. In fact, very few, from what I've seen, roll into the emergency department after having that short transport time from the scene and are intubated imminently on arrival. So I think from the emergency department, we often have the luxury of a little bit more time than we were traditionally taught.
And of course, those comments are predicated on having an ALS EMS service with advanced airway practice, because if a BLS crew is transporting this patient, you very well might have someone who is crash intubated on arrival. But Dennis's point is well taken. If you have a good ALS crew, then they're either going to make the decision that this patient's okay or they're going to intubate already. Let's zone in on a few issues. Let's first deal with a center that is a receiving burn center. And then we'll take the issue of a transferring center in a sec, because I think the variables change a little bit. So you're at your shop, you're the burn center, maybe they sent this patient to you, and is there anything that would make you want to intubate that patient immediately? I'm sure there is. So I should ask again, what would make you intubate a patient on arrival with an inhalation injury?
I think I'll look at two things. One is the actual injury itself. So if there is evidence of the patient deteriorating with all those findings of singed facial hairs and coughing up sputum and hypoxia and looking distressed, I think those are the ones to get on right away. The other group are going to be the comorbid patients that we see. You know, not the 24-year-old healthy patient who is caught in the garage fire, but the 72-year-old COPD-er on home oxygen who was smoking and then the fire started, and you know that their baseline is already compromised, and then they come in with a new injury, and you know that this is not going to go well. So those patients, you're probably better off capturing the airway sooner rather than later. So I kind of look at those two big features.
All right, makes sense. And obviously, if we have a patient in respiratory extremis, their saturation's already dropping, they're stridulous, they look like crap, then that's an easy one, right? You're going to intubate that patient.
Definitely. And I think, you know, all of our listeners will be right on for those patients and won't wait. You know, the other group that we're going to look at is the patient who comes in with a big burn. So let's say a 50% burn involving their legs and their lower anterior torso and their back and their arms, but not their face and not their upper airway. And they're sitting there on 2 liters of oxygen. They don't have a carbon monoxide injury and they're doing okay. But you know that that 100 kilo patient with the 50% burn is going to get a lot of fluid over the ensuing 24 hours. And you know that they're going to go for an operation and you know that they're going to deteriorate. So those are the patients that will be intubated electively, but they don't have to be done right away. They don't have to be done under panic. We don't have to call out all the stops to make sure that this is going to, you know, go the way it should. They may be the patients that can be approached like any other semi-elective intubation.
That was actually on my list, so you hit it. That's perfect. It's just big burns themselves may necessitate an eventual intubation. Okay, let's go back, though, to inhalation injury. Is there any virtue or help with rhinoscopy to help you make the decision?
You know, I think that's going to be a local thing depending on your comfort. Certainly in my own practice, for the patient who comes in who looks good from, you know, the way they're breathing and their comfort level, but certainly they're burnt about their upper face and burnt about their neck, if I feel that it's safe to do so, I will take a nasopharyngeal bronchoscope and I'll walk it down the, you know, down the nose and down the oropharynx and take a look at that upper airway. Now, that doesn't really tell us what's going on within the trachea, because most of us aren't going to take that nasal bronchoscope and push it through the cords and take a look down. But I think it is going to give us an indication of that upper oropharynx, that supraglottic area. If it looks beefy and red, if there's a lot of carbon sitting in that area, you're going to back your way out. You're going to very cautiously and carefully call all your other supplies and all your other people to intubate this patient soon. But more often than not, we'll take a look down those patients and they look very good and we'll feel better about them once they're intubated. So I do agree the nasopharyngeal bronchoscope, if you have one available and if you're comfortable using it, is a very good adjunct to do for these patients.
All right. So I had a patient a few weeks ago, came in with a house fire burn, burned about the face, singed nasal hair, and definitely vocal changes from our perception and the patient's self-perception. A bunch of secretions in the airway, very juicy in there. Put the rhinoscope down, and it was so much secretions and coughing that we could barely see anything, but it was pretty clear there was edema in the periglottic area. The cords from our brief glimpse looked okay. My inclination would have been to tube this patient because I'd err on the side of safety. Our grizzled burn surgeon came down and said, nah, he'll be okay, and put him in an ICU. And the patient did fine. So the question is that an okay line to draw in your practice? Where do you err if I wanted to put you on the spot? Are you a let's wait and see because they're coming to my unit anyway, or are you a let's just do it at this point?
You know, I think I have those similar conversations with my grizzled burn surgeons as well. There seems to be a lot of, you know, it seems like if you intubate a patient and you didn't need to and you extubate them soon, that is almost seen as a failing measure. Whereas in my perspective, that's a success. I can take a tube out that shouldn't have been there a lot easier than I can put a tube in that should have been put in 4 hours ago. Now, that being said, this is a patient who is sitting in a tertiary care institution, who's going to be sitting in an intensive care unit, who has that high-level nursing and high-level continuous support, and you can intervene on them as they deteriorate. You know, is this someone who's going to go to a regular ward? I don't think so. So we do have the luxury of all that stuff around us. And I think those are the ones that we can limp through. I think from an eMERGE perspective, or certainly from a referring in perspective, that patient is probably better intubated. And then I can always extubate them when they get here.
Well, that brings us to our next set of questions. So now you're at a transfer center. You're at a community place. You have no burn support people at all. So you're going to transfer to the burn center. How low does your bar now drop for intubation for transport?
I certainly think the bar will drop lower. I think you have to be more suspicious and pessimistic about that patient. You know, the variables come in. How far is that transport? Who's transporting them? What are their skill level? Is it a BLS crew with a 3-hour transport? Is it an ALS crew with a 15-minute transport? Do you feel confident that you've observed that patient in your department a suitable enough time to determine whether they're going to deteriorate. If they've only been there for 5 minutes and you're sending them, you really haven't had that luxury of time to see what they're going to do. But if they've been sitting with you for 2.5 hours and there's been absolutely no change and they look just as good as when they came in, those are the ones I feel more comfortable about. But I think, again, it comes down to, I can say whatever I want from my receiving end, but when you're the doc out there and you've got that patient in front of you and you're going to put them in the truck and send them away, caution is a good thing.
All right, that's fair. So now you're back at your receiving center and someone on the phone is transferring a patient to you and they're like, well, there's some singeing in the nasal hairs. You know, the patient seems pretty comfortable, but you know, they're coughing every now. I don't feel comfortable. I'm going to intubate. And you're like, well, are you sure it's only 20 minutes? And they're like, no, I don't feel right. I'm going to do it. And now you get the patient and you turn off their propofol. They look okay to you. Would you ever extubate a patient like that at time zero or maybe like, 20, 30 minutes into their ED arrival, their eMERGE arrival? I'm sorry for my Canadian friends. Or would you say, look, they're already tubed. Let's wait until a few hours or a day from now. Let's take them through their first primary dressing change before I'd extubate them.
I think the risk with any of these patients having them intubated for too long is the fact that we are going to generate some edema in some inflammation just by the presence of the endotracheal tube. So let's say it's a little bit of a bigger tube, the patient is coughing, they're fighting because they're probably, healthy and vigorous underneath all that, you may generate some edema and you may make it more difficult to extubate. So I will say that I will aggressively extubate them if I feel that that's indicated. Extubations are never a rush. We know that they're a very elective procedure. I do remember a case I took care of about 5 years ago with three individuals who were all burnt in the same area. There's a flash fire inside a coker, one of these large oil refining type things. And they all got hit in the face with an inhalational injury. And the first guy got it the worst. And then the second guy was behind him. And the third guy was behind him. They were all intubated. They were all sent in. And, getting three intubated burn patients in an ICU is a big deal all at the same time. The third guy we extubated right away, the second guy we extubated the next morning, the first guy was intubated for about 3 days. But we did need to move things along just to kind of desettle the unit a little bit from a severity standpoint.
Makes sense. All right. This patient now, we have sickness going on. They have a big burn and they have inhalation injury. There's no question in our mind, we're intubating. So do you recommend using a big tube for what's going to come down the pike for pulmonary toilet?
I think certainly a tube that you can put a bronchoscope down. If the tube is too big, there may be those issues with tracheal edema because that's going to come into play. Cuff pressures and checking out your pilot to make sure you're not causing too much intrinsic subglottic pressure and necrosis. A larger tube, enough that you can get bronchial toilet, is important though. So I guess from the other side is if the tube is too small when it was first put in and you take a look in and you see maybe a bigger one could go in, that might be the time to change it over.
Okay. So let's really, force you to put your down to the mat here. So what size, if you were in the eMERGE and intubating a patient like we just described, would you grab?
So certainly I think a 7.5 EVAC endotracheal tube would probably be the minimum that I'd want. Our own institution, usually once the tube gets down to about a 7, it's tough to get the bronchoscope down, especially one with a good suction port is the big thing. So you can often take a look, but can you suction out the garbage that's down there? So 7 minimum, 7.5 desired, 8, fantastic.
I'll put my own 2 cents in here and say your 7.5 is your absolute minimum, but there's really very few patients who cannot take an 8.0, and that would be my tube size of choice in these patients. We intubate every single patient with 8.0, and I can't remember a time in the past, 8 years where we just had to grab a smaller tube size in a patient who didn't have something else going on. Now, obviously, all bets are off if there's significant cord edema. At that point, you just put in whatever you can, and we could always change it out later on. So if you're worried, always have a much smaller tube prepped and ready to go along with your big tube. Okay, so now we have our tube in. Patient goes up to the ICU. This was a bad inhalational injury. At what point are you doing a bronchoscopy on these patients for pulmonary toilet?
So I'll do bronchoscopy very early on for two reasons. One is for diagnosis, and the other is potentially for treatment. So when you look down and you see all the carbonaceous sputum that's down there, we try not to do a bronchoalveolar lavage, because the problem is if you push in a lot of water, you're going to move stuff around, and you may move that soot down farther than you could access. But we will do a lot of suctioning. So it takes a long time. You'll be in there for 45 minutes, and you'll be sucking out this glue, essentially. Looks like tar, and you'll pull it out. If you can get out those big particles, that will help. The important thing is you also have to look at the other parts of the airways. So remember, our endotracheal tube is going to be in the distal trachea. The bronchi, the carina, might look fine, but what about the upper trachea? So if your patient is stable and you're comfortable, you may have to pull that tube back to get the bronchoscope to look at the upper part of the trachea and then put your tube back in a safe position. I would also advocate for looking at the supraglottic area. That may involve a GlideScope, taking a look to see if that upper airway, look at those cords, see if they're beefy and red and heavily involved with thermal injury. The other part about looking with the bronchoscope that I think is not as well recognized is the fact that it may help guide your resuscitation. In our earlier discussions, we noted that there are risk factors for the difficult resuscitation. One of them is inhalational injury. The presence of a severe inhalational injury will almost invariably increase your fluid requirements for that patient. Knowing that early on is going to help you. A, because you won't be as surprised when you're needing more fluid, but you're also going to be extra judicious to make sure that you don't overload that patient. Those airways are very edematous, they are very inflamed, and they can actually close down quite a bit if they get a ton of fluid. So I'll do it from a diagnostic standpoint and also do it from a therapeutic standpoint.
Fantastic. All right, you get in there with your bronch. This patient is filled with carbonaceous stuff. When I did my rotation at the burn center, they were doing something interesting that may or may not have fallen off the radar, which is they were using high-frequency oscillatory ventilation with a partially deflated cuff, and you would just watch this crap bubbling out of their mouth on a continuous basis. Is that still being done?
You know what? I've heard of it done. I haven't seen it. You know, our center used to be sort of the oscillating center before some of our other studies came out. So we haven't done it as much. Now, I certainly think anecdotally it could help. We haven't used it in practice, though.
All right, fair enough. Okay, this is a little bit tangential to the airway topics, but I think it's a perfect thing to fit into this part two, which is in these really bad burns, it can become super difficult to secure things like IV lines, and yet getting them back again if they fall out is a real torture. What tips do you have for access on these patients? Do they all need central access, and how do you keep them from falling out? And as a addition to that, how do you keep your endotracheal tube from falling out when you can't now do taping to the face?
I will start out with the vascular devices. So ideally, if you can stay away from central lines, that's great. However, we know with these big burns, they're going to be around for a while. There are going to be a lot of medications and fluids and ORs, et cetera, so they will need central lines. Again, are they crash central lines? No, they shouldn't be. But before they get 20 liters positive, it's probably the better time to get your access. Be aware of the sutures. Be aware of the depth of that suture. Encourage your resident or whoever's putting that line in to take a good deep stab with your suture as they're going down. The other thing is, as time goes by, check those sutures periodically, because sometimes they get so edematous, they pop, and then you'll have to put another suture in. And I've lost a number of lines over the years of ones that were sutured in, and I know I did it myself, and 3 days later the line comes out because there was no suture. So make sure they're well secured. Peripheral IVs are great, but be aware that as that patient becomes more and more edematous, that IV line will retract a little bit and may eventually come out. So be careful of the interstitial line that may be running a harmful fluid. As far as endotracheal tubes, I think, Scott, you've probably seen a number of different devices that can secure these airways, and a lot of it seems to be local culture as well. For the longer stay patient, our surgeons will often put a wire, sort of as they would for a mandibular fracture repair. They'll put a wire through the teeth and around a tooth, and they'll secure that tube with a wire. And just knowing that these patients, especially when they're burnt about the face and the head, are going to be sticky and sloppy and edematous, and it's going to be impossible to keep tapes in place.
All right, fair enough. Now, in deep down in the recesses of my memory, I seem to remember that the really bad burns are more prone to a specific type of peripheral IV line infection that we don't see in patients with intact skin barrier, and it could be a big issue. Am I remembering correctly, or am I just making stuff up?
Well, certainly they're going to be at higher risk for all sorts of skin infections. And, you know, I think that's the big challenge with the burn patients, is that once they survive that first 48 to 72 hours of actual burn resuscitation, the thing that will kill these patients down the road is infections. And it's often coming from the skin. So any Lyme site, whether it's peripheral IV or central Lyme, is high risk. And a big ongoing debate that we have is, when do you change lines? How often do you move them around? You know, if your patient's in the unit for 6 months, that's a lot of central lines if you're moving them around every single week. So when do you go with it? I think in our right general systems ICUs, we've gone towards the side of change them when they don't work, or change them if you are very confident there's an infection. In the burn world, there's still a spectrum of regular changes, despite what the line looks like, towards keeping them in as long as you need until something's wrong.
Okay, for any completionists, like I am a member of that category, it did come to me, the infection of the IV sites is suppurative thrombophlebitis. So if you need to look up what I was talking about, that is the term, suppurative thrombophlebitis. Okay, back to it. Fair enough. You know, what we missed is the peripheral line securement. Do you stitch them in when they come up to the ICU? Or do you just let them with the sticky stuff until they look loose?
If I remember, I will put a stitch in. But oftentimes I'm forgetting about that. So certainly they end up just getting taped on.
All right. Are you putting arterial lines in all these patients because of the difficulty of getting a blood pressure if both arms are burnt?
So I think the arterial line access in these big burn patients is going to be important. If they are circumferential limb burns, especially to the arms, you're probably going to want to avoid that area. So they may have to be femoral arterial lines. Again, anticipating any impact on that circumferential burn is going to be a problem, and you'd like to minimize the amount of the fluid or edema of that limb.
All right, perfect. Anything we should add to this part two, Dennis?
Scott, one thing I'm going to bring up for inhalational injuries is treatment. We see this and we wonder, well, what can we do to make this better? So there have been a number of studies over the years looking at things to make inhalational injury better. As with every other thing in critical care, steroids have been studied in these as well and have been found not to be beneficial. There have been studies looking, as you mentioned, at different modes of ventilation, and probably doesn't make a big difference. The biggest thing that may be out there in the literature that our readers and listeners are going to hear about is that of aerosolized heparin. So aerosolized heparin, the thought is that you're going to get a benefit with regards to inhibiting the fibrin clot formation that happens as you aerosolize heparin into these airways. There is benefit in animal studies. There is suggestion of benefit in pediatric studies. And in adults, we're just not sure. There are some prospective studies looking, saying that this was better, having it inhaled heparin every 4 hours, usually in a mixture of Ventolin and mucomist or N-acetylcysteine, and other studies saying that it did not make much of a difference and may have made the patients more prone to pneumonias. Depending on where you work, they may or may not use aerosolized heparin. We have not adopted it, but once in a while, someone will pull it out for a treatment plan. So be aware that aerosolized heparin is still a bit up in the air as to benefit.
All right, fair enough. I have one last question, and then we will be done with part two. And the question is this. We've discussed on the podcast before the actual cellular toxins that could go along with inhalational injury, things like carbon monoxide. If you have a bad burn and a patient with a high CO level, and yet you're in the circumstance, which for inexplicably in the States happens a bunch, the burn center is disparate from the hyperbaric center, which makes no sense to me at all. And so now you have to actually choose, do I take this bad burn to the burn center or to the hyperbaric? Which would you choose, and what goes into that decision?
That's a question that's very near and dear to my heart, Scott. In my center, our burn center is not the same as the hyperbaric chamber center. They're about 20 minutes away, and there's a bridge and a river in between the two. So when the big bad burn rolls into our tertiary care burn center and there's a big carbon monoxide injury, that exact question comes up. Our decision is the patient will not be transferred for hyperbarics, that we will put them on 100% oxygen. You know, if you look back at the Weaver study back from 2002 in New England Journal of Medicine, looking at hyperbarics, the neurologic outcomes were favorable. Now, over the years, the study has been looked at a little bit more and felt maybe it wasn't quite as strong as we thought it was back then. There's a Cochrane collaboration from, I believe, about 2011 that went over the evidence or the available evidence and came out with the conclusion that hyperbarics for carbon monoxide injuries was maybe not as strong as we thought. And they were still thinking that more prospective RCT type studies had to be done. That being said, when you have an unstable burn that needs a lot of resuscitation, Q1 hour assessments, complex burns, a lot of dressings, I think the last place you want to put that patient is inside a hyperbaric chamber where you are not next to them. So certainly we have moved away from it, and we will not transport a patient to a hyperbaric chamber if there's a large burn and a large carbon monoxide injury.
All right. Well, there you go. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show again, Dennis, and we will bring you back for part three.
Scott, looking forward to it. It's been great chatting with you guys, and hopefully we can talk some more.
Well, there you go. Fantastic stuff from Dennis. Like I have said, we will do part three. We might even do part four. If you have questions, put them in the show notes. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're having a new member of the MCRIT Project family, and that is the Tox and the Hound. Included within that, the Dantastic Mr. Tox and Howard podcast. This is amazing. So I'm just going to roll there. Introduction from the Dantastic Tox talking about both of those things. If you're not interested in Tox, then find a new career. But if you're not interested in Tox, then you could stop listening now because there'll be nothing else from me, just from my new colleagues on the site. Talk to you soon. Scott Weingart, MCRIT Podcast, saying bye-bye.
The Tox and the Hound on today's episode of the Dantastic Mr. Tox and Howard Show. Welcome, poisoned patrons, on this, a day that will live in toxfomy.
Oh, I thought we wanted to start off on a good foot.
Tox for me. I like it.
Tox for me. All right, Tox for me. I got it. I got it. I got it. Oh, Lord. Yes.
So, big announcement today. Yes. Howard, tell our fans what we've been alluding to for the last 3 months.
Yeah, 2-3 months. So we are very excited to announce two big things. The first is a partnership. The second is a piece of information, a foam resource. So they're both combined together, but the Dantastic Tox and Howard Show will continue, but we are now becoming part of a new toxicology blog, which is going to be called The Tox and the Hound. And Dan, who is going to be partnering with us, and where can they find The Tox and the Hound?
Oh, we have literally the greatest collection of toxicologists that said yes.
Yes.
we have.
They're going to listen to this, you know.
Yeah, we have Jeff LaPointe, Diane Colello, David Yerlink, Brian Judge, Chris Holstedge, Howard Greller,
woo!
Dan Rusiniak.
Megan Spires. Andrew Stahlback.
Sarah Schaefer. Andrew Stahlback.
Kavita Babu.
I think that's it, isn't it? That's 11.
Yeah.
11 world-renowned toxicologists who said yes.
Exactly. Exactly. So in this mighty group of suckers that we were able to coerce to join us in this endeavor, we're going to be putting together this blog to talk about all things toxicology and to foam out little information, little fun. And in addition to that, I think the other exciting aspect of this is that in doing so, we have partnered with MCRIT.org. So the MCRIT Collective, we are going to be the toxicology home on the MCRIT site. So we're very, very excited. Want to give a special thanks to Scott Weingart for reaching out to us and for agreeing to listen to our nonsense.
Yeah, and for giving us full editorial control over everything we say. I'm guessing we're on it a month. I'm giving us a month.
That's it, and we're out.
I think that's the
probably.
That's the over under. I don't know how long he allows us to stay on his very popular website.
Or else use the name, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we hope that you'll enjoy what we have and join us on this continued journey. It's going to be toxinhound.com. That will be your one-stop shop for all of this, including the Dantastic Mr. Toxin Howard, which will also be found there as well.
Yeah. Or you could go to the MCRIT site, and we'll have a link there as well.
Yep.
So we hope you enjoy. We'll be interested in getting your feedback on this. We will be putting out weekly content, and we're hoping that we become the big dog in foam tox.
Oh, oh, oh.
Tox for me.
Tox for me. All right. We'll see you on the web.